no sense.
This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. Welcome back to the Relic Radio Show, 60 minutes of old-time radio drama brought to you every Tuesday by RelicRadio.com. Our first story this week comes from Escape. We'll hear their broadcast from January 7th, 1951, titled Conquest. After that, it's Living Fiction and the Heart of Midlothian, their episode from January 23rd, 1954.
You, finding life rather dull, dreaming again of exotic places, wishing you were somewhere else? We offer you Escape.
Escape with us now to the windswept peak of Mount Everest and the story of a man who sacrificed everything to climb it, as Leonard Lee tells it in his gripping story, Conquest.
You want to know what it's like up there? I'll tell you. It's a constant torrent of wind and snow. It's jagged rocks iced as slick as a knife blade. No man has ever set foot on the place. It's as bleak and barren and lonely as the moon. But it's Everest. Mount Everest. And when you stand on its peak and know that every inch of the world is below you, there in the palm of your hand lies the final conquest.
We're not going to make the mistakes Norton and Somerville made. We'll spend the first night at Camp 5 and the second night at Camp 6. That brings us to 26,800 feet.
Are you going to make the north face to the Kulwar, Mallory?
No, that's what they did. We're going to make a frontal attack, direct. We'll follow the crest of the northeast ridge to the peak.
Yeah, that's tougher climbing.
The only chance, Hamilton. And we'll take oxygen on the last dash.
Well, best of luck, Mallory.
Thanks.
We watched them as they left Camp 4, 23,000 feet on the face of Everest. Mallory and Irvine, stocked with their provisions. Pitons, carabiners, hammers, axes, packboard, snowshoes. Two diminishing silhouettes against the powder snow of the Rongbuk Glacier, finally disappearing behind a jut in the North Col. We watched them and prayed for them. And we hated them, because we weren't part of that final run to the top. Two days later, June 10th, 1924, a man crawled toward us in the snow. We ran out of the tent to get him. It was Odell, our geologist from Camp 6. He could hardly speak. Chaloner, brandy.
Yes, here, Odell, drink this.
Thanks.
What happened?
I saw them. I saw the top.
Did they make it?
I don't know. They were about 800 feet from the peak. Mallory and Irvine. At the last step. The last step. Then the mist closed in.
It's only a matter of time. They'll make it.
Hamilton. No man can live up there. There's nothing to breathe.
And that was the last word. Somewhere in that jungle of ice, their frozen bodies lay. The peak was still unscaled. We looked out at the expanse of desolation stretched out before us. We looked out and up. The calm arrogance of the summit was wrapped in mist. From that moment on, there was only one purpose to my life: to climb that mountain.
sorry, Hamilton. No more money.
Look, Ben, I can make it. I know I can. I've been up there. I know every crevasse. I know every rock up to Camp 6.
Well, what's the point? So you reached the peak. So what? The bear went over the mountain. What did he see but the other side?
All right, all right. I don't expect you to understand why people climb mountains. It's a kind of insanity. Let's let it go at that. But from your viewpoint, look at the publicity. Grisham sports equipment used on the first ascent of Mount Everest, the highest mountain in the world. It'll be worth $1 million to you.
You have a point there.
The initial expense, including everything, will be about $25,000.
$25,000? It's out of the question. The best I could do would be $15,000.
I knew you'd say that.
What?
$15,000 is plenty. Well, what do you say, Challoner? Are you with us?
Well, the last time it was pretty rough, but I'm always fool enough to try again.
Fine.
Who have you got lined up so far?
Langmuir. He's pretty young, but he's got a lot of energy and a lot of experience for his age.
Uh-huh.
Newt Revere, you know him. Four of us will lead.
That sounds pretty good. How about financing?
The Mount Everest Committee can't supply it all, so I got most of what we need from Grisham. He makes sports equipment. It's a publicity deal.
I see. Well, it's March now. We ought to have our base camp established by mid-April, and then we'll have about a month of climbing before the monsoon hits.
Yes, that's what I planned. We'll be leaving in about 10 days. Can you be ready?
Yes, I'll be ready, Hamilton. And so will Everest.
We arrived in Darjeeling on April 2nd. We hired Sherpa porters and Tibetan guides, bought more tents and scientific equipment, and headed toward Everest, 100 miles away. But it was almost three times as far, snaking through the gorges of the eastern Himalayas. Our second night out, we camped in the sweltering swamp jungle of Sikkim.
I can't sleep.
Try a wet towel on your head.
I've tried everything. Hamilton?
Yes?
Can you sleep?
No.
If you ask me, we should have taken the south slope. Gets more sun, less ice. Do you hear me, Hamilton?
Yes, I heard you.
Well, why didn't we try the south slope?
Because the north slope is explored and possible. Besides, Nepal won't grant permission.
Let's try to sleep, hmm?
Can't sleep. Too hot. Can you sleep, Revere?
I could try if it weren't for all this talk.
Hold it. There's somebody outside. Yes, who is it?
Tichba Marani.
The head porter.
Oh, you better tell him to come in, Hamilton.
Come in. Yes, Tichba, what is it?
Not go. Not go to Chomolungma.
What?
Signs very bad for mountain. Death. Death, I see.
What signs?
Bend of the trees and the stars. No good. Not go to mountain.
All right, Tishbe. How much?
I do not understand.
The bend of the trees is worth how much?
Oh, signs are bad. $500.
Get back to your tent.
$400. $400, a blessing from Holy Lama of Rongpo.
All right. But that's the last holdup. You understand?
I'm sure signs will be better.
Now get back to your tent.
Oh, gladness. Gladness.
There's a Gurkha for you. The Sherpas won't come around for more money in the middle of the night.
Well, good night, gentlemen.
It's too blasted hot.
Enjoy the heat, Langmuir. In another 48 hours, you'll wish you had every steaming bit of it. We pushed on through the Sikkim to the Tibetan plateau. The mercury plunged to zero. The wind and snow lashed at us. We'd begun to climb. We stopped at the monastery on the Rongbuk for the Lama's blessing to satisfy the porters and moved on up the glacier. 12 below now. And then, in the momentary clearing of clouds, I saw it once again. Everest and the white plume flowing from its peak. We were at 16,000 feet. It was at this point we established our base camp. All right, Challoner, tell them what we've decided.
All right. Camp 1 will be at 18,000. Camp 2 will be at 20. Camp 3 at 21. Camp 4 at 23. I will each carry oxygen. The tanks are light, but we'll have enough to last us for about a week if we use it right. When we get near the top, The routine will be 15 minutes of climbing, 1 hour's rest.
We're not making the mistakes Mallory did. Are there any questions?
Yes. How do we pair off, Hamilton?
Challoner and Revere, Langmuir and myself. We'll travel together up to Camp 4, then we separate into doubles. The rest of the men will be dropped off at the camps as we move along to maintain relays. Anything else?
Yeah. I think we're going to make it.
We climbed over the icy slopes, establishing camps as we went. Finally, after days of driving forward inch by inch, we reached the North Col, just 7,000 feet from the summit of the mountain. The wind hurtled down in the slopes and a sweeping gale, hard and cold as rock. Mallory had camped here, just days from his death. Night closed in. The lack of oxygen had numbed the mind and fired the temper. Our civility was suffocated. We were savages, nothing more. We sat around an alcohol flame, the four of us, breathing hard, staring at each other's bearded faces, while outside the wind beat at the tent flaps.
Gotta have oxygen.
You've had plenty.
Can't breathe.
You can breathe. Just take it easy. Any more oxygen, your body will stop regulating to the altitude, then you won't be able to do without the stuff.
My heart's going like a trip hammer.
It'll get worse.
I gotta have some, I tell you.
Sit down. Stay away from that tank.
I can't breathe. Hamilton, I can't breathe.
I said stay away. All right, come on, now get up.
Oxygen. Please.
Sit up and behave yourself. I'm the leader of this expedition, and you'll do as you're told.
Here, Langmuir. Give me a hand.
No. Let him lie there, Challoner. He'll be all right in the morning. In the morning, Revere and Challoner set out to establish Camp 5 at 24,000. Langmuir and I watched them go, chopping their way up the ridge to the northeast shoulder. When we lay down, waiting, trying to conserve our strength, Langmuir stared upward, his lips moving in prayer. Deep sunk eyes, chest heaving. The next day we set out, following Challoner's marks.
Langmuir, body belay.
Right.
Easy now.
I can't.
100 feet, Langmuir, then we can rest. Now come on.
No.
Take a little more oxygen then. There. Do you feel better?
More.
No more. Now come on. Quarter shell to the camp.
Quarter shell?
He stood on my shoulders and I boosted him to the narrow ledge. He grasped for the edge, his fingers clawing at the smooth rock. I felt his foot slip from my shoulder. I grabbed for his leg and missed. Black space sank below us and he fell.
Escape, under the direction of Norman MacDonald, returns in just a moment. CBS wishes to call your attention to the debut of three programs today. Bill Goodwin's entertaining Dollar a Minute, a new 15-minute news program featuring Eric Severide, chief of CBS Washington Bureau, and Charlie Wilde, private detective, which has moved to CBS from another network. And now, back to Escape.
As Langmuir fell, I braced myself against rock, waiting for the rope around my waist to pull taut. And when it jerked, it burned into my flesh and tore me into space. I scrambled under the double weight, lunging desperately for a hold. I threw my arm around a snub of rock just at the edge and started to pull up. Slowly, I reached the ledge, gasping for air. I looked down. Langmuir was swinging at rope's end in a small arc above the yawning emptiness, just 100 feet below me.
The wind tore at my face. My arms were aching. I felt them slipping from the rock, and then I saw Langmuir grab a handhold and start to climb. And the rope loosened, and I relaxed. He was all right. I sniffed at my oxygen, but it made me drunk. 3 hours, I told myself. 3 hours to Chalon.
Hamilton. Hamilton, you all right? It's Challoner. Are you all right?
Yes, I'm all right. How did I get here?
Langmuir brought you in.
I must have passed out.
Yes, you certainly did.
Where's Revere?
A rock fall. He must have been killed instantly.
Three of us left. We haven't even established Camp 6.
Look, Hamilton, I'm not a young man anymore. I'm 38. That's fine for selling shoes in a department store. Not quite up to this kind of thing. I just about reached my limit, Hamilton. You and Langmuir, you two will have to climb alone from here on up.
I think we can do it.
I'll stay here at Camp 5.
All right, Challoner. I hope I get a good sleep. Because tomorrow I've got a date with the mountain. It's quiet outside. It's a wonderful day. It's the best we've had yet.
What do you think of cutting the north face across the couloir, making the final ascent directly up the western part of the north side?
No, we'll take Norton's route as we planned.
What about Camp 6?
Well, if we can establish it at 27,000, the final dash will be short. That'll double our chances. Well, Langmuir, what do you say? You want to go on?
Look up there.
What?
The mist is beginning to clear. There it is, Hamilton. The summit. The top of the world.
We started up again, up toward the summit. Our altitude was 25,000. We planned to camp at 27, leaving only 2,000 feet for the final spurt. We hung desperately to the sheer face of the mountain, the freezing wind whipping up from the great couloir tearing at our grasp. All the next day we inched upward, our hearts pounding. By nightfall, we had only reached 26,000. We had to camp or die. Hephaldus found a small recess. We pitched our tent over it, fastening the stays with pitons. We huddled together in the cold darkness. Langmuir was exhausted. I heard him gasping the weak air. My arms and legs were swollen with pain, my lungs bursting. The top seemed miles away. Every ache in my body urged me down, down to the firm, warm earth. But the peak, only 3,000 feet, the White Plume Peak.
26,000. Only 26,000. We'll never make it, Hamilton.
You can see it in the daylight, the peak, Langmuir.
We'll go like Mallory went up there. Suffocation.
We'll make it.
Suffocation. No air. Nothing to breathe.
Stop it, Langmuir.
We've got to go. We're back.
We're not going back. We're going for the top.
We've got to go back.
3,000 feet, that's all. 3,000 feet and we're there.
Mallory, he couldn't breathe. He's here, somewhere. Dead. Frozen dead.
We'll make it.
Tomorrow morning we're going back.
Langmuir, we've climbed tougher ones than this in the Rockies. The slopes aren't hard. From here on, it's simple. We'll
Hamilton,
make it, Langmuir.
We've got to go back.
We're not going back. You understand? We're going to make it.
Hamilton!
Listen to me. If you try to turn back, I'll kill you. The mountain wasn't ice and rock to us anymore. It was a human force, an arrogant, wild challenge. Defiant,
fighting conquest with choking cold and the constant earth pull downward. Death didn't matter. My life a Langmuir. That was the top, and we were going to reach it. In the morning, we started up again. We moved like automatons, not daring to think or feel. Moved up by instinct. And then it happened. Langmuir slipped again, and I plunged my pickaxe into a crack and waited for a sharp tug on the waist rope. It came. I pressed myself against the rock, waiting for the slack that told me that he'd regained his foothold. And suddenly, above the high wind, I heard a massive rumble. I felt the earth shaking itself to pieces. Avalanche! No space. There was only the mountain and me. I climbed. I kept climbing. The sky darkened. The wind rose. The air was like a blade in my throat, but I kept going. And when it was too dark to climb, I dug myself into a hollow place. And I lay there, thinking of home, of the sanity of the open fire, of the comfort I'd left behind. Night on Everest. Night on Everest and the terrible wind. Morning broke milder and clear. I left the hollow and looked upward through the glare of the sun. The slopes were more gentle, the holds easier. It was as if Everest had suddenly relaxed its guard, for there, just above me, lay the few yards of level terrain which formed my goal. I started again, moving upward, senseless to pain. Hours later, the ground leveled and I stopped crawling. I lifted my head, and around me, in every direction, clouds and peaks. Below me, the black outline of the earth. I'd made it. I was the first man ever to reach the peak of Mount Everest. I forced myself to my feet, weaving dizzily. All the pain, all the intense agony of the altitude and the climb was forgotten now. I looked down at the magnificent peaks of the surrounding Himalayas. I couldn't believe that I'd done the impossible. There was a small camera in my knapsack. I took pictures of every horizon. I walked around the summit, my summit, drunk with the knowledge of what I'd done. And then, suddenly I stopped. For there, wedged into a crack of rock, something bright and gold shone up at me. I bent down and pulled it out.
It was a cigarette case. It bore the initials GLM. George Lee Mallory. I stood there trembling, the cigarette case in my hand. An instant before, I'd experienced the elation of the greatest possible triumph. And now there was only defeat. Defeat and the indescribable hate for a dead man. Oh, how he must have smiled as he went to his death, knowing that the second man to reach the top would find his proof. The second man to reach the top. I was only the second man. And then it came to me. Why must anyone know? Why must I tell the world what I'd found? Mallory was gone. He wouldn't hear the applause. It would be me, Chase Hamilton, the man who had conquered Everest. I took a small plate of metal from my wallet and wedged it into the rock. It read, Hamilton Everest Expedition, 1925. Then I strapped on my sack. I looked below me. It would be a difficult descent. But there was only one direction to go now. Down.
You at about 1,000 feet from the peak. Is that right, Mr. Hamilton?
Yes, that's right. Challoner found me. He brought me back to Camp 6.
How come Langmuir didn't go to the top with you?
He died, gentlemen. The rope broke and he fell. Langmuir deserved a lot of credit, though. Without him, I never could have gotten near the summit.
Well, how does it feel, Mr. Hamilton? How does it feel to be acclaimed as the first man to climb the highest mountain in the world?
Well, gentlemen, I feel as if...
If you could just give our papers a statement of some kind, how does it feel to be the very first?
Yes, that's what we want to hear, sir.
You don't climb a mountain just for fame and glory, gentlemen. You climb it for something more personal than that. And you can't lie to yourself.
I'm afraid I don't understand. You were the first.
No, gentlemen. Not quite the first. George Lee Mallory reached the top last year. I found his cigarette case wedged in a rock on the summit. This cigarette case. Smoke, gentlemen.
Under the direction of Norman MacDonald, Escape has brought you Conquest by Leonard Lee, especially adapted for Escape by David Ellis. Bill Conrad was starred as Hamilton. Featured in the cast were Larry Dubkin, Ramsey Hill, Lou Krugman, Jack Crucian, Larry Thor, and Ben Wright. The special music for Escape was composed and conducted by Del Castillo.
Next week, escape with us to Western Europe and the story of a futile attempt to save a beautiful girl from the clutches of the most cold-blooded political organization on Earth, as Anthony Ellis tells it in his exciting story, A Bullet for Mr. Smith.
Next Tuesday evening, CBS has a big treat in store for all of you. Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Amos and Andy, Bob Hope, Mary Martin, Judy Garland, and a raft of other stars will be on hand to salute Bing Crosby, who is celebrating his 20th year in show business. Be sure and join them on Tuesday. This is Roy Rowan speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Living Fiction. Northwestern University, in cooperation with the National Broadcasting Company, brings you a radio dramatization of a timeless story, The Heart of Midlothian by Sir Walter Scott, the first in a series of Living Fiction. The people of Scotland give to their great writers not only admiration, but affection. No novelist has come closer to the hearts of his own people than Sir Walter Scott. You are to hear a dramatization of one of his great works. And so, without more ado, let me turn the page and show the scene. It is noon in Edinburgh, and before the prison door, the ancient door to the prison called the Heart of Midlothian, stand two people, a girl named Jeannie Deans, and a young minister of the gospel, Reuben Butler.
Leave me here, Reuben.
But, Jeannie...
I'm glad you came this far, but... Reuben, I wanted to tell you that all must be ended between us.
Ended?
Yes.
Oh, no, Jeannie.
It's best for both our sakes, Reuben.
And for what should it be ended? Oh, true, your poor sister lies here in the prison accused of child murder, but... Well, it lies neither at your door nor mine.
Reuben, I...
No, no, it cannot break plighted troth, Jeannie. Or they that plighted their word wish to keep it?
No, Reuben. I'll bring disgrace to no man's hearth.
Jeannie, are you sure that it's only your sister's distress that causes you to talk this way?
And what else could it be, Reuben?
Well, then...
Is it not a long time since we've spoken together in this way?
Aye. A long time. Sufficient for a woman to weary.
Of her old gown, perhaps. But not long enough to weary of a friend.
Yes, but
then... Oh, the wish may change, but the heart... Never.
Well, then, Jeannie...
Please go, Reuben. Please.
Very well. But I shall be waiting and watching over you. Goodbye, Jeannie.
Goodbye. Oh, heaven, give me strength.
Who's so bold as to knock here? Who are you, young lady?
I am Jeannie Deans.
Oh, to be sure.
I've come to see...
Your poor sister. The provost warned me to let you in. This way, then, and mind the chains now. Tis a bad business, Jeannie Deans. Very bad. The law is awful strict on those who make way with their little ones.
My sister Effie never made way with anyone. She's the victim of a cruel law.
Ah, yes. I heard the lawyers talking about it. Now, if the poor girl could produce one witness who will testify that she made no secret of the birth of the child, she would have a good chance of acquittal. It would remove the guilt of concealment. It's a bad thing, that concealment. Here we are. I'll have to go in with you. It's the rule.
Effie?
Who is it?
Oh, Jeannie. Effie, you're ill. You're very ill.
Ill? What would I give to be 10 times worse, Jeannie?
Oh, Effie, how could you have concealed your situation from me? Had you spoke but one word...
Oh, what good would speaking have done? I went away among strangers and had my child, and I swear that it was taken away from me during the night. Oh, my poor baby, where is it now?
One word, Effie, but one word. If I were free to swear that you had said how it stood with you, they couldn't have touched your life this day.
Couldn't they? Who told you that, Jeannie?
Those who knew what they were saying well enough.
The lawyers?
Yes, yes. If you had mentioned your child to me before it was born, the law could never convict you of secretly...
murdering it? That is what they say. Oh, before heaven, Jeannie, I do not know where the infant is.
I believe you. But the law is the law.
If I had spoken... Jeannie.
Yes, Effie?
Have the lawyers asked you to say something that would save my life? Is that it?
Why, they suggested that I forswear myself.
I see. And you told them that you wouldn't hear of coming between me and the death I am to die.
I told them that I dared not swear to an untruth.
And what do you call an untruth? Do you think a mother would or could murder her own child?
Effie, I believe you as innocent of such a purpose as the newborn babe itself.
Then, Jeannie, why?
If only it stood with me to save you with the risk of my life.
Aye, Jeannie, that's bravely said, but not so bravely credited from one who will not speak a word for me.
But that word is a grievous sin, Effie.
Oh, Jeannie, I mind all about such sins. We'll speak no more about it, and you may save your breath to say your catechism. And as for me, I'll soon have no breath to waste on anybody.
Oh, Effie, dear.
I must say, Jeannie Deans, it's cruel hard when three words of your mouth...
Never speak more of it. It's just as well as it is. And a good day to you, sister. You'll not keep the guard waiting.
Effie, are we to part this way, and you in such deadly peril? Oh, Effie, look up and say what you would have me do, and I'll find it in my heart to do it.
Ah, lass.
No, Jeannie. I'm better minded now. At my best, I was never half so good as you, and why should you begin to make yourself worse to save me? I'm not worth saving. God knows that in my sober mind, I wouldn't want any living creature to do a wrong thing to save my life.
Time's up.
You'll come back and see me before...
Effie. Effie.
Come, lassie. That's enough now. Time's up.
Let me in here.
Wait a bit, laddie. Where do you think you're pushing?
I'm Reuben Butler. Isn't this the courtroom where Effie Deans is being tried? I'm afraid...
Wait a bit. Steady now. The courtroom's full. Besides, the trial is near done. They're calling the last witness now.
A witness for the defense? Who?
This poor Effie's sister, I believe.
Jeannie. Oh, I beg you, God, let me in. Jeannie and I... Well...
It's like that, eh?
Yes.
Well, here. I'll open the door a wee bit, and you may stick your head in and listen.
Oh, thank you, God.
But not a sound out of you, laddie.
No, not a sound.
Jeannie Deans, you come before this court in circumstances which it would be worse than cruel not to pity. Yet it is my duty to tell you that the truth, whatever its consequences may be, is what you owe to your country and to that God whose word is truth and whose name you have just invoked. Use your own time in answering the questions that will be put to you. Counsel for the defense, you may take the witness.
Jeannie Deans, you are, I think, the sister of the prisoner?
Yes, sir.
Not the full sister, however.
No, sir. We are by different mothers.
And you are, I think, several years older than your sister.
Yes, sir.
Now think carefully. Did you observe your sister's state of health to be altered during the last few months?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, indeed.
And she told you the cause of it, I suppose.
I'm sorry to interrupt, my learned brother, but I must ask your lordship's judgment as to whether this is not a leading question.
If this point is to be debated, the witness must be removed.
It is not necessary, my lord. Since the king's counsel thinks it is worthwhile to object to the form of my question, I will shape it otherwise. Pray, young woman, did you ask your sister any question when you observed her looking unwell? Take courage. Speak out.
I asked her what ailed her.
Very well. Take your own time. And what was the answer she made?
She...
Take courage, young woman. I asked what your sister said ailed her when you inquired.
She said nothing.
Oh, nothing? True, you mean nothing at first. But when you asked her again, did she not tell you what ailed her?
Alas... She never breathed a word to me about it.
Jeannie! My own sister!
Jeannie!
time is it, guard?
Time and more for you to leave, Master Butler. You've been walking up and down this hall for 2 hours. Now, why don't you be a good fellow and go on? Oh.
I never...
Well, then, it's all over. Now, they're coming out. I'll see if I can find out the first. T'was the sister's fault.
Aye, all she had to do was say a word or two.
Well, is it done? What was the verdict, sir? I pray you.
Guilty it was, of course.
Guilty?
Aye, to be hanged by the neck upon the gibbet. Though why the sister...
Come now, clear the cord. Out with you. Out.
Clear the
cord.
What are you...
I'm going now. Wait just a minute.
God have mercy on poor Effie.
Reuben? Reuben!
Jeannie. Oh, my poor girl.
Poor indeed now. You've heard them?
Yes, Jeannie. It's sad.
You've seen how they look at me. Reuben, I could no more...
I know.
But there's still something I can do. Reuben, I'm bound on a long journey.
What?
I'm going to London to ask Effie's life of the king and queen.
You go to London? You address the king and queen?
And why not?
Oh, Jeannie, this is entirely a wild dream. You can never see them, save through some great lord's intercession.
Well, maybe I can get that, too, with a little help from you.
From me? Jeannie, how?
Reuben, haven't I heard you say that your grandfather did some good long ago to the grandfather of the Duke of Argyle?
The Duke? Why, of course. He did so, he saved his life, and I can prove it.
Well?
Jeannie, I'll write a letter to the Duke and beg him to stand between your sister and this cruelty. We must try all means.
Aye, we must try all means. But writing a letter alone will not do it. It's word of mouth or nothing, Reuben.
You're right. But, Jeannie, you mustn't take this journey alone. You must give me a husband's right to protect you. I'll go with you myself.
No, Reuben. You would take me with all my shame. But this is no time to marry or to be given in marriage.
Jeannie, I swear to
you... You're a man of God. You must let me depart alone. Keep up your heart for my sake, for if I am not your wife, I will never be the wife of any living man. Now write me the paper for the Duke of Argyle, and bid heaven speed me on my way.
Look at the wench with the bare feet.
Oh, where do you think you're going, young woman? Tramping the high road so early in the morning.
To London, friend.
London? Oh. You've a long walk before you, lassie.
Give our regards to His Majesty the King.
Thank you, I will.
Not stay here in York another day?
No, I cannot stay. Every minute is precious.
Well, God be with you. And if you return this way, stop at the inn and ask for me.
I will. Goodbye, Mrs. Bickerton. Goodbye.
And don't forget to seek out Mrs. Glass at the Sign of the Thistle in London. She'll give you a room for love of me.
I'll not forget. Goodbye, then. Goodbye.
Gypsy.
Please.
Such creature. Get away from my door, you beggar.
Mistress, if I could just rest for
get
an hour.
Get away with you. No honest woman walks the road this
please.
Time of night.
I'll put the dog on her. Oh. Here, walk, here.
Out with your purse, wench!
Here's my purse, but there's nothing in it.
For empty as the king's head. Well, I'll keep it anyway.
The necklace is silver chain. Snatch it off.
I have it.
The wench has fallen down.
Well, let her lie. We'll try the other road, Benji.
Aye, Slippery Jack, the other road.
Toward London?
Yes, your ladyship.
Then climb in the carriage here.
Oh.
You're staggering and about to faint.
Oh,
My blessings on your ladyship.
Whip up the horses, Thomas. We've a good distance to go.
London, your ladyship?
Yes, girl, this is London. Black and smoky and noisy and never sleepy.
So this is London.
Where shall I put you down?
The place on this bit of paper. Mrs. Glass at the sign of the thistle.
Oh, yes, I know her. To your left, Thomas. To your left, you fool.
You'll not rise up till you've had another bowl of soup.
Oh, it's very good.
Imagine you coming all the way from Edinburgh, and to see the Duke of Argyle, no less.
I cannot eat any more, Mrs. Glass.
I know. Your mind is all of a skelter till you see his grace. Well, I'll send the lad with you to show you the way. Richie!
Richie, you lazy lump!
What is it, Giles?
It's a country girl from Scotland, Your Grace. She's asking...
From Scotland? Well, show the lassie in.
This way, young lady.
Did you wish to speak to me, my bonny lass, or the Duchess?
My business is with your honor, my lord. I mean, your lordship's grace.
And what is it, my good girl? Leave us, Giles, and wait in the anteroom.
Yes, sir.
Sit down, lassie. Did you come through the streets in your tartan?
No, sir, I came in the street coach.
Well, what's your business, my bonny woman? Time and tide, you know, wait for no one.
Your honor, I mean, your grace.
Never mind my grace, lassie. Just speak out.
Sir, I'm the sister of that unfortunate Effie Dean.
I've heard that story. A case of child murder, wasn't it?
I've come up from the north, sir, to see what can be done in the way of a reprieve or a pardon.
My poor girl... You made a long and sad journey to very little purpose. Your sister is ordered for execution.
Yes, I know. Only I understand there's a law for reprieving her if it's the king's pleasure.
Certainly there is, if it's the king's pleasure. Tell me, girl, what possessed you to address yourself to me?
It was yourself, sir.
Myself? I'm sure that I never saw you before.
No, sir. But all the world knows the Duke of Argyle is his country's friend. And, well, I have another reason for troubling your honor.
And what is that?
But take this letter, sir, and read.
My grandfather, captured by English troopers, his life saved by Stephen Butler. Why, yes, I recall the story during the Stuart troubles. Well... This Stephen Butler was your grandfather, I suppose.
No, sir. He was grandfather to a neighbor's son. To a sincere well-wisher of mine, I mean.
I understand. A true love affair, eh? Stephen Butler was the grandsire of the lad you are engaged to.
Was engaged to, sir.
He's not deserted
you. Oh, no, sir. He would be the last to leave a friend. He's a young clergyman, sir, and... It wouldn't be right for him to marry the likes of me.
You're a singular young woman. What reason have you for thinking your sister innocent?
Because, Your Honor, she has not been proved guilty.
A good answer, lassie.
God bless you, sir, for that very word.
It's contrary to English law to take that for granted, which is not proved.
Yes, yes.
But what can I do?
I'm only here because you alone can answer that.
Confound it, well... I'll do what I can do.
Yes, sir?
Well, never mind. Leave us now, and you shall hear from me tomorrow. And, by the way, wear your tartan. Oh. And be ready when I send for you.
Oh, I will. Oh, and, sir, don't be beaten back or cast down at the first rough answer.
I'm not apt to mind rough answers, lassie. I'll get along with you now.
Yes, sir.
I'll do my best. But God has the hearts of kings in his own hands. Thank you.
is this affair, my lord?
Your Majesty, the matter concerns an unfortunate young woman in Scotland, now lying under sentence of death for child murder. It is highly probable that she is innocent. My humble petition to your Majesty is to obtain your powerful intercession with the king for a pardon.
I've had enough of Scotch pardons.
If your Majesty would condescend to hear my countrywoman herself.
She's here.
Outside the door, your Majesty.
Well, let her in, then.
This way, lassie. Now bow low.
Stand up, young woman, and tell me what sort of barbarous people your country folk are, where child murder has become so common as to require the restraint of laws like yours.
If your ladyship pleases, there are many places besides Scotland where mothers are unkind to their own flesh and blood.
You should tell this lady the particular cause.
Be silent. Now, how did you travel up from Scotland, young woman?
Upon my foot mostly, madam.
And you must have had a very fatiguing journey, and I fear to little purpose. Since if the king were to pardon your sister, in all probability it would do her little good. For I suppose your people of Edinburgh would hang her out of spite.
They'd bless his majesty for showing compassion.
His majesty has not found it so lately. I suppose my lord duke would advise him to submit to the will of the rabble?
No, madam. But I would advise his majesty to be guided by his own feelings and those of his royal wife.
My lord, all these fine speeches do not convince me of the propriety of showing favor to your very disaffected and intractable city of Edinburgh.
But your ladyship...
Speak, young woman. Have your say and be done with it.
My sister Effie still lives, though her days are numbered. Oh, madam, if ever you knew what it was to sorrow for a sinning and suffering creature whose mind is so tossed that she can neither be called fit to live or die... Have some compassion on our misery. Save an honest house from dishonor. And an unhappy girl, not 18 years of age, from early and dreadful death. Alas, it is not when we sleep soft and wake merrily that we think on other people's suffering. Our hearts are light within us then, and we are for fighting our own wrongs and fighting our own battles. But when the hour of trouble comes to the mind or to the body, and when the hour of death comes, well, that comes to high and low. Then it isn't what we have done for ourselves, but what we have done for others that we think on most pleasantly. And the thought that you have intervened to spare a poor thing's life will be sweeter in that hour than if a word of your mouth were to hang all the disaffected men in Edinburgh.
Madam,
this is eloquent. Young woman, I cannot grant a pardon to your sister, but you shall not want my intercession with the king.
God bless your majesty. I think, Jeannie, you have every reason to congratulate yourself on the manner of your interview with Her Majesty.
But she promised nothing.
Ah, no, Jeannie, the pardon is quite certain.
What does Your Honor say?
The pardon is certain. There is no doubt of it.
Oh, God be praised. God be praised. And may the good lady never want the heart's ease she has given me this day. And God bless you too, my lord.
As to this pardon, I must get it passed through proper form. I have a friend in office who will do that favor for me. And then, Jeannie, away to Scotland with it by fast messenger. Meanwhile, you may write to your friends by post of your success.
And does Your Honor think it will do as well if I were to slip my ways home again on my own errand?
Much better, certainly. But the roads are not safe. Jeannie, I have a plan for you. One of the Duchess's attendants and one of mine are going to Scotland in a light carriage. And there'll be room for you to go with them. Oh, now will that do?
In a grand carriage? Oh, your worship. I mean, your lordship, your grace. Does your honor like cheese?
Like it. Cheese and cake are dinner for a king.
I'll send your worship the biggest cheese in all Scotland.
Thank you.
so beautiful here at Rosenheath. Effie, you'll not stay another day.
Oh, no, Jeannie. I've stayed too long as it is. I have all the happiness I deserve now that I've seen you, and nobody shall say that I came with my cheek the gallows face to shame my sister among her grand friends.
Oh, I have no grand friends. None but who are friends of yours. Reuben Butler and our father. Oh, Effie, it's better sheltering under an old hedge than a new planted wood.
It's in vain speaking, Jeannie. I must follow my husband.
Your husband? I'll say no more, then. If he's in hiding and an outlaw to the king, as I suppose, your place is with him.
He has never found our child? No. He believes the gypsies stole the infant away while I slept and he was hiding from the king's officers.
Well, you'll go to the house and say goodbye to our father, at least.
That I will do. And now, for I see one coming who would be much happier with you alone.
Oh, Effie,
Oh, no, Jeannie, stay. And remember, you're no longer in Edinburgh where tongues are long.
Good morning to you, Mr. Butler.
Mister? Why, Jeannie, what's come over you?
I was bred to show respect to a minister of the gospel who has his own parish.
Well, 'twas your influence with Argyle that won me my parish,
oh,
Jeannie.
Oh, no, Reuben. 'Twas the letter about your grandfather.
Well, whatever it was, I'm come to ask you...
Oh, to go to the house? Because my father wants
me.
No,
not at all, Jeannie. We...
Is it a song you're singing to me,
Reuben? It is no song. I'll ask you again.
I'm sure that my father wants me.
He hasn't spoken a word for you. Jeannie, listen.
Well, then I'm sure that I want to see my father.
Oh, blather, Jeannie. Will you stand still a minute?
Mr. Butler... 'Tis a question I must ask my father.
Well, the question can wait. I have one myself.
Oh, Reuben, you look so foolish. 'Tis surprised my father will be when I ask him how he would like to see his daughter a minister's wife.
A minister's? Oh, Jeannie, stand still.
And how can I move with your arms around me, Reuben?
The Heart of Midlothian by Sir Walter Scott is the first in a series of living fiction presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with the National Broadcasting Company. The Heart of Midlothian was adapted for radio by Herbert Gorman. The cast and directors were students of Northwestern University. Jeannie was played by Nancy Kafestian. Reuben by Bob Reitz. Effie by Faith Kellogg. Queen Caroline by Millette Alexander. And the Duke of Argyle by Richard Swift. Others were Dave Adams, Earl Bark, Toby Carlson, Marie Chisholm, Vivian Newberg, David Press, and Bert Weil. The assistant director was Bob Pitt. The director was George Hurd. The entire production was under the supervision of John Cowan. This is Hugh Downs speaking. This is the NBC Radio Network.
That's the Relic Radio Show for this week. I hope you liked our selections this time. You can hear a lot more from Escape, a few more from Living Fiction at RelicRadio.com. Just visit the website, search them out. You'll also find past episodes of this show there, all the other podcasts, our Shoutcast stream, and our donate button. If you'd like to help support this and all the shows, give that button a click. Your support makes all of this possible. My thanks, as always, to those who have, and thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next Tuesday with another hour of the Relic Radio Show.